the timing of this talk, of course, coincides with one of the things we wanted to think about, and this is, I guess, where it fits with the how we might think about civil society, is this idea of the referendum bringing Aboriginal people into modern political rule. So beyond the moment of the referendum that's been covered a fair bit in the last few weeks, there was a really interesting documentary that Frances Peters Little was screened on SBS, she's a graduate from UTS. Beyond that sort of description and understanding of the referendum and what it achieved, I guess what we're sort of looking to do today is to consider what happened, what those new powers conferred, I guess, and how... in my paper, and I'll just move on to my paper now, I should say my name's Heidi Norman, and I'm a senior lecturer now at the Jumbana Indigenous House of Learning. I'm soon to move over to the Humanities Faculty. So in my paper, this was a research this is a larger paper, this smaller section that I'm presenting today was a research commissioned by AATSIS. So it's the first time, really, I've sort of presented it, so I'm really grateful that you're here to be an audience to this work. So what I've really tried to set out to explore or to investigate is how the Council for Aboriginal Affairs, I'll explain that in a moment, and the Commonwealth Government sought to bring Aboriginal people into national political life. And that's indebted to Tim Rouse's account, really. He develops this in great detail, this idea of national political life and his study of Nugget Coombs's legacy in Aboriginal affairs. So my starting point, and that others have made, is that the referendum is precisely this moment where Aboriginal people are brought into modern political rule. So in recent years, the Commonwealth Government's role, with advice from the Coombs-led Council for Aboriginal Affairs, has been described differently, largely as a failed socialist experiment by conservative think tanks critical of communal land tenure and self-determination. Others, like Noel Pearson, he's been largely referring to the 1966 equal wages case to suggest that the post-67 referendum created this environment of, welfare poison and toxic policies that created a dependency. And he's articulating a preference for real economic participation and associated market values of reciprocity. And again, we see these sort of ideas in the Howard government's hand-picked National Indigenous Council, where they've talked about economic development initiatives as the way to go, so including home ownership, private individual home ownership. And you would recall Warren Mundine drawing on his proud experience of being a homeowner in Sydney here, ironically, to suggest that being a homeowner engenders a different mindset. So it engenders this idea of being responsible and holding down a job. The quiet revolution that's being talked of in Indigenous affairs purports to be discontinuous with the failings of the policies and programs of the past, so the council era, the post-67 era. This criticism suggests the socialist policy advice of the council and Commonwealth welfare instigated not just a lived experience, but a mentality characterised by a lack of responsibility and ambition to become social and economic citizens. So it's a weird arrangement of government, the market, and extending market principles to the social and cultural values of Aboriginal people and society. So my intention here is to think about what ideas the Council for Aboriginal Affairs had, what sort of rationalities, political rationalities, underpinned how they sought to bring Aboriginal people into modern political life or national life. So in doing this, the Council was influenced by the recommendations made in a major survey, and part of the recommendations by the Social Science Research Council were the incorporation of Aboriginal groups within the decision-making processes and assistance with negotiation of transfers of lands to property corporations to be used by Aboriginal communities. So we know that the overwhelming success of the referendum saw the then Prime Minister, Harold Holt, commit the Commonwealth Government to making significant changes in Aboriginal affairs. And he did this by recruiting three members to form the council and a small office of Aboriginal affairs. So they were there to advise him directly on, as he termed it, Aboriginal advancement. And the people he recruited to that council, I'm sure I'm going over old ground here, but it was Nugget Coombs, who was a former head of the Reserve Bank. I guess he's generally referred to as a charismatic intellectual and a reforming and had some sort of reform role. The other was Stenner, and Stenner was already an established anthropologist. He had a chair at the Australian National University, and Barry Dexter. So my study focuses on Barry Dexter, and Barry Dexter was much younger than the other two. Both Coombs and Stenner came out of retirement to be a part of that three-member council, whereas Dexter was a career public servant. At that stage, he was a senior public servant, although still fairly young. His experience was as a diplomat in the South Pacific. I don't know if that was relevant to him being brought on board. And they were persuaded to take up the role after assurances from Holt that Aboriginal advancement was going to be a key priority for the government and that the council would have executive powers to investigate and consult, make recommendations directly to the Prime Minister. So they had a guarantee of a direct line of communication to the Prime Minister, to executive government. As I move through this material, I've looked at Dexter's unpublished manuscript called Pandora's Box that's located in the Ayatsis Library. What I came to understand was that Dexter, unlike the other two, Coombs and Stenner, as a bureaucrat, he was really at the coalface of the sort of machinations of modern power, so between the governments, the different departments, heads of departments. And for the council, they had an unusual status. They were sort of outside of government, so they were advising government, but they had this sort of unusual status. And over time, Dexter, of course, from 67 through to 72, came to head up the first Department of Aboriginal Affairs, as well as be the chief officer of the Council for Aboriginal Affairs, while they continued their work up until 1976. So you can see those. The three men that formed the council, they had a significant period of advice to government. Over that same period, there was something like five prime ministers, several ministers in charge or ministers for Aboriginal affairs. So they were quite a continuous presence throughout this significant period after the referendum. So what I was trying to struggle with before is that saying they're in the service of government and they're advising government. So they're unusually placed in relation to, you know, how government is organised. And it's probably worth saying that without, they were despised by most, including the Aboriginal community at different times, by the ALP left and conservatives alike. What Dexter suggests, and as I mentioned, I'm sort of telling this story through his vantage point as the kind of bureaucrat, he highlights the multiple sites of hostility to changing the policy of assimilation, and yet he also inadvertently shows the council's inability to escape its logic. This hostility to the council's attempts to tinker with the assimilation policy, it shows a complex array of those opposed to any changes, to those who sought greater community control, to really petty rivalry over power and privilege. There are stories of armed hold-ups in the department, Senate inquiries, accusations of financial mismanagement, public service board inquiries, protests, sit-ins, a whispering campaign, as Dexter says, vicious personal attacks and enchanted affection. But above all, Dexter helps us to understand the operations of government, how policies are developed, thwarted and operationalised. So moving on to the council to try and sort of excavate their kind of ideas or their political rationalities. The council were first and foremost opposed to providing welfare. This included through the state and territory-based Aboriginal welfare departments and initiated programs aimed to develop economic independence. Pearson's historical survey of the welfare state argues welfare has been experienced differently by Aboriginal people. He says it's become a destination rather than a safety net. However, in my reading, the council never advocated welfare. They were never about welfare. They rallied against any welfare option. They articulated their position and advice to government as being one of creating real economic opportunities. The council were mindful that most Aboriginal communities were almost wholly supported by government subvention. In the Northern Territory, this came under the training allowance. And they were informed by research that estimated the rapid growth in the size of the Aboriginal community and estimated back in 1968 that by the turn of the century, the Aboriginal population would be around 400,000. And as it turns out, they were spot on. So it was the council's belief that an effort should be made to establish viable local enterprises which would reduce dependence on government support funds. And they were saying things like, before it's too late. So they were anticipating the ongoing or the longer term sort of social welfare burden. And they set out to do this in two ways. Firstly, the heart of the council's policy was one of first initiatives negotiated with the government, and it was the establishment and funding of the Capital Fund for Aboriginal Enterprise. This initiative was about communities, mostly in traditional, unassimilated contexts, as the council saw them, becoming organised along lines faithful to cultural modes of organising, with a view to developing enterprises and assuming a role in the running of one's community. This highlighted a particular development, the bringing into political life as economically viable citizens. The intention of the Capital Fund, with an initial allocation of $5 million in the 68-69 budget, was to establish self-supporting economic activities among communities. So the council facilitated research, they explored options, including, as it was at the time, government-run enterprises, and even enterprises or businesses inside departments, with ministers on the board of directors and so forth. So they were drawing on departmental capacity as well as academic and industry advice to assist communities to develop viable enterprises. And these, the ideas and research were coming in thick and fast. They included a wool carbonisation plant in Walgett, cattle stations, for example, Everin Park in South Australia, turtle and crocodile farms, a tourist shop at the international airport. It could go on and on and on. They were, some of them were far-fetched, some of them were, sounded like kind of reasonable propositions. So the second initiative from the earliest days of the council was to change the welfare-based Aboriginal departments operating in the states and territories. It's worth noting that the so-called welfare departments were in various ways, according to the sort of state-based regimes, operating along cost recovery or even profiteering lines. So, for example, there were various claims made on mining royalties on Aboriginal land in the Northern Territory to cover the cost of servicing the reserves. Similar practices were apparent in the states where payments, wages and payments, welfare payments and wages were claimed by the relevant state body to cover the costs of the reserves. The council, their argument was that they were not interested in assuming any sort of executive role in the administration of Aboriginal affairs. They were committed to ending the authoritarian welfare-based departments, but from the outset, they advocated a devolution to the functional departments and were, for the entire life of the council, opposed to this omnibus approach. So their argument was that, and I quote Dexter, A classic example of the ills of such a system. Aboriginal people being denied the professional service of functional department or agencies in favour of underfinanced and amateurish services. A big widening gap between the material circumstances of Aboriginal people and those of the general community, and being kept away apart from the Australian community at large. So that's how they reasoned their push to return from those designated welfare departments to functional departments. So this meant that housing, for instance, rather than being located in a separate Aboriginal welfare department, would be taken up in the relevant Department of Housing. So their thinking was that the expertise and adequate funding would follow from that devolution. And it was also a shift from the idea of services and programs based on welfare to need, so as it was accepted in the wider community. So from the earliest days, the council held very firm ideas that were anathema to state welfare. So they were saying, Dexter, and I quote, he's saying, welfare policies pursued by all Australian governments over the previous 30 years or so had been towards providing things for Aboriginals, doing things for them. In 1967, there was little thought of the Aboriginals genuinely doing something for themselves. He went on to say that all aspects of their lives are controlled by authority, whether by state or missions. But the changing of the state and territory welfare departments cut across complex and entrenched views on how best to deal with the Aboriginal problem. Differences between the Country and Liberal Party, as well as their respective political strongholds, the economic base that absolute control over Aboriginal people for land and development, and some other dimensions that were peculiar to the Aboriginal affairs domain. So I'm thinking, say, Nicole would know more about this. In Queensland, you had people like Killoran, who these were really entrenched senior public servants who had headed up the welfare department in Queensland, and there were characters like him dotted all over the country, who were so wedded to their administration, to their career, to the rightness of what they were doing, that it was as much a kind of personal, emotional embeddedness as a sort of ideological. So, for example, when the council first had a role at the Commonwealth-initiated meeting of the state, all of the state officials in the territory, of course, at this very meeting, the battle lines were drawn. The states appeared with extensive shopping lists and with great hostility towards any sort of interference, or was perceived to be interference, from the Commonwealth. So the states were really jealously and with real determination guarding their administrations. So my thinking here is that, as I wind up, that the council and later department were informed by particular liberal rationalities that characterised how they came to construct Aboriginal interest. I don't think it was welfarist along the lines of the Pearson criticism, or socialist as others have suggested. They were fundamentally committed to creating enterprising communities as a means to social and cultural freedom. But there's one other dimension that I just want to quickly explore, and that is that that the policy of assimilation was so pervasive in the administration of Aboriginal affairs, the council's effort to modify the existing assimilation policy, it didn't amount to a radical change in policy. I think we can see great continuities between the shift from assimilation and eventually with McMahon's... it was a statement, he didn't present it, it was a statement that was tabled at the Cairns Conference in 1971. And that was the moment, that statement introduced the idea of integration. So it was some 4 years into the, or nearly 4 years into the role of the council in this push towards a different kind of policy regime, that integration came to be suggested. And the council were at pains to say that they were not anti-assimilationists. So if we understand this context of modifying the assimilation policy, to the right were the entrenched supporters of assimilation, including the Country Party members, and their strongholds, as I mentioned, in the Interior and Queensland, and the Conservatives in the Liberals. But it was more than just an unstinting commitment to assimilation. It played out in securing the stability of the country and Liberal government, the coalition power base, and the long-held views of the senior bureaucrats and members of Parliament, especially those in Cabinet. And of course, there was an emerging agitation from outside of government at the slow pace of change that the council were advising on. So, the council's position on assimilation, Dexter explains as it was a more pragmatic one. He says that they observed the total failure of Aboriginal society to assimilate in accordance with the then policy. The shattered remnants of Aboriginal tribes over the previous two centuries, we were convinced that the remaining traditional-oriented communities, and perhaps some others as well, would be effectively integrated into Australian society only if they could retain their cohesion, structure and traditions. And, of course, traditional land rights was central to that. So what we see is the continuities between the council's position on integration and assimilation. The council's position to alter the authoritarian administrations in the states was a form of mainstreaming, while their capital enterprise fund was a means by which to organise Aboriginal people as a community in order to conform to the requirements of governments who would be actively engaged in the management of one's own affairs. So it was really, it represented an ambitious undertaking that was not discontinuous with assimilation, but worked on the subjectivity of a community of citizens in relation to government as economic citizens.